The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. Lots to talk about today. There's a new poll out. The press still doesn't get it. A new poll out from The Atlantic on why people voted for Donald Trump. We will try to help them through that. Ay, ay, ay. Ready or not, the robot society is coming and what it means for your job and the future of your children. Also, Ivanka Trump has a new book out called Women Who Work. The reviews of this book are astonishing. No one could be this bad of a writer. I haven't read it, but I'm guessing the reviews are a little skewed. Who would have thought that? We'll actually ask for your help to correct that here in a second. Also, Ed Henry is going to be joining us. He's got a new book out called 42 Faith. How can you erase the faith of legends and expect to understand their life? It's what society is doing all the time. Ed Henry is trying to restore the faith of one very famous person in history, that if you don't understand their faith, you don't understand their story. Except I've never read anything about this man's faith until today. Also, the Senate subcommittee hearing. Clapper and Yates will give you the update, because quite honestly, that's all I can take of this, beginning right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
All right, let's get started with the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee hearing. This is Clapper versus Yates. If anybody watched it, good for you. What the hell is wrong with you? Seriously, what is wrong with you at this point? That's what you pay us for in your time. We'll watch that crap so you don't have to. Let me summarize what happened. Yesterday, the subcommittee held a hearing about Russia's interference in the presidential election last fall. We heard from the director of national intelligence, James Clapper. I can't believe I used James Clapper and intelligence in the same sentence. But he was with former acting attorney general Sally Yates. Now, if you are like me, that's enough to make you turn the radio off and just listen to the sweet hum of your engine. Especially if you're in the garage still and the door is closed and your windows are open. Just breathe deep. It'll all be over soon. As these hearings tend to go, we didn't get any actual, I like to call it information that's important. Some in the press would call it bombshells. I'd settle for some actual information. Clapper confirmed that European intelligence reports are accurate about contact between Trump advisors and Russian officials before the election. Clapper said the specifics are quite sensitive. Yeah, but this is the same guy who told us a caliphate is ridiculous. There's no such thing as Muslim extremism. He's really not the guy to go to. More than anything, it was the theatrics of the day that further clarified the focus of both sides. This is going to come as a shock to you. Just if you're still awake in the garage, just press the brake pedal just a little bit, because it'll make me feel better that you're not moving your car when you hear this, because this is going to take you by surprise. What we found out yesterday is this is all about politics on both sides. No one in Washington actually seems to be interested in finding what I like to call the truth. The administration is there to defend their narrative at all costs. The opposition is there to destroy the president at all costs. Never mind the fact that Russia actually screwed with our presidential election, that they are influencing the culture of the United States of America. And also don't mind that the government under the Obama administration was leaking sensitive critical documents and names and information. Don't worry about that. Get him or save him. James Clapper has a record of credibility. I was going to say that is as long as Anthony Weiner's credibility, but that probably... Anyway, in his open remarks, he said, the Russian government pursued a multifaceted influence campaign in the run-up to the election. Yes, we know that. We told you they would do that 2 years prior, including the use of cyber capabilities. The intelligence community assessment concluded, first, that President Putin directed an influence campaign to erode the faith and confidence of the American people in our presidential election process. Yes. Second, he did so to demean Secretary Clinton. Yes. And third, he sought to advantage Mr. Trump. Yes. Not because he likes it or Mr. Trump was involved. The conclusions and confidence levels reached at the time in January still stand, end quote. Later, he said the evidence of Russia interference in the election was, quote, overwhelming. Now, despite the fact that Clapper is generally as believable as, a United Airlines customer or customer service representative, this is unprecedented. This is serious stuff. It is worth paying attention to. It's not just another stupid thing from Washington. It's just being treated as if it's just another stupid thing in Washington because both sides are involved. You know what this is? This is Sandy Berger getting caught in the National Archives with documents in his underpants. You notice Bush didn't do anything. Clinton didn't do anything. Why? Because both of them are involved. Both sides. Nobody wants the truth to come out. When the president hopped on Twitter, and I can't believe I just said that sentence, his tweet targeted the choice of Sally Yates. Now, Yates is the former acting attorney general that he fired because she wouldn't enforce his first travel ban. You remember where the one where he hated all Muslims and basically anybody who wasn't white and foreigners. He tried to keep all of them out of America because they were Muslim, non-whites, and foreigners. Yeah, I don't remember her any either. Donald Trump is still smarting from that executive order fail, so he was more concerned with insinuating that Sally Yates leaked classified information about General Flynn to the media. For the record, Yates told the subcommittee that she did not leak anything about Flynn to the media. Yates told the subcommittee that she warned the White House legal counsel that Flynn could be a risk of blackmail by the Russians because they knew he talked about the Russian ambassador during the transition about possibly lifting sanctions against Russia. Our side knew that. Flynn knew that. The Russians knew that. But he wasn't telling anybody about it. Flynn later told Mike Pence that he didn't discuss the sanctions, which is part of the reason he eventually got the boot. Yates was fired a few days later, presumably for refusing to enforce Trump's travel ban. Now, here's the only new revelation yesterday. It was that Obama apparently warned Trump not to hire Michael Flynn when Obama and Trump met in the Oval Office 2 days after the election. The White House confirmed this yesterday. Sean Spicer said Obama simply didn't like Flynn because Flynn had been an outspoken critic of Obama's lack of strategies. This is what happens when you politicize everything. If you've politicized everything and everyone, when you try to give good, solid advice to somebody on the other side, they're like, that's great. Thank you so much for that advice. Now get out. Spicer added that if Obama was seriously concerned about Flynn's connections to Russia, he should have revoked Flynn's security clearance. Flynn was always a terrible appointment by Trump. But for some reason, I just don't think that Obama's words were going to change anything, no matter what he said or did. Obama's record of credibility is actually a tad lower than Clapper or Weiner, but maybe that's just me. I think in the hierarchy, or in this case, the lowerarchy of credibility, it goes Clapper, Weiner, Obama. three-way tie. You throw in about, I don't know, 400 other representatives, a few thousand lobbyists, and everyone else you've seen quoted in the Washington Post, and you really have the ultimate tie in the race to the bottom, which I think is very nice. And if it could be a bottom, if we could put a chain and maybe an anchor on that boat, I'm just saying. Now, can you imagine the collective gasp if the Trump White House actually owned their mistake? If they actually just came out and said, yeah, we screwed up. We didn't vet Flynn carefully enough, and we regret hiring him. We're going to try to do better because we got to get out of this Russian mess. Or if the Democrats said, you know what, if Clinton won, we wouldn't care about this at all. And if next time the Russians are helping us, we'll forget any of this ever happened. We probably need to work on that because we really suck too. Can you imagine hearing that? Well, I just want you to know, nothing like that happened yesterday. In fact, just the opposite. It would be like them... stepping up to a microphone and saying, yeah, you know why this doesn't make any sense? Because we're all doing heroin here. That's what's happening. Yes, America, the state of our union, our political union, is still strong and very, very fragrant. That is the update on what happened yesterday with the Senate. Now let's talk about anything that actually happened of importance to you. Well, they're not reporting on any of that. Good night, everybody. Actually, here's something that happened in Arizona that I'm trying to find out because, you know, it's not reported. And so I would think that it's not true. But then again, this is the kind of thing that they never report, so I don't know what to believe. Have you heard about the shooter in Arizona, in Phoenix? The, what do they call him? The serial street shooter case? They've caught him. Aaron Juan Sacedo. Originally arrested April 19th in connection with a fatal shooting in 2015, he was rebooked into the Maricopa County Jail on Monday, now faces 26 charges related to the serial shootings in Phoenix. This is incredible to me because have you ever heard of the serial shooter case in Phoenix?
Unless you're in Phoenix, I don't think it was a big story at all.
Not a big deal. Police Chief Jerry Williams said at least two more murders, including the 2015 shooting, had been linked to the serial shootings, bringing the death toll to 9, but brought the total number of shootings to 12. Can somebody quickly look up? Do you remember the shooter, the sniper in Washington, D.C.?
John Allen Muhammad.
Yes.
With Lee Boyd Malvo.
Which had nothing to do with anything. Why are you bringing up Muhammad?
I was reading his name. I thought it was important to say his name.
What a racist.
He shot, it killed 17.
He killed 17. Do you remember how big that was when he was up to 5?
Yeah.
We haven't heard. This is number of shootings, 9. And the number of killed, I'm sorry, number of killed, 9, shootings, 12. Phoenix is a lot smaller than Washington, D.C. How is it this isn't everywhere? Other than, hear me out, the Mohammed thing was happening in the nation's capital where all of the elites and the press always hang out. And so when the press is affected, it's like snowstorms. If it snows in Washington, D.C. or New York, my gosh, that's all they cover. But if it snows like it always does everywhere else, they're not covering it. They're not saying that's not wall-to-wall coverage because it doesn't affect them. I swear to you, if it doesn't happen in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., or New York, it just didn't happen. Just didn't happen. And they wonder why people voted for Donald Trump. They wonder why people don't trust the media. Well, because you won't admit that you can't even see outside of your own towns. I've not heard of the serial shooter in Phoenix, Arizona. They just caught him. And when I read it, I read his name. Now, he may have been born in America, lived in America, maybe here legally. We have our share of dirtbags.
Yeah.
But you never report on if this guy is illegal or not. You never report if Mohammed was Mohammed and a Muslim or not. That had nothing to do with it.
Nope.
Because it doesn't fit your agenda when you do cover it. I have no idea what the truth is of the story, but we're looking into it now.
Glenn Beck.
The fusion of entertainment. And enlightenment.
We are one. The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
888-727-BACK.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program.
Okay. By the way, Marshall just tweets, I live in Phoenix and I've never heard of the serial killer.
Go ahead. Give me the tweet again. I didn't hear it.
I live in Phoenix and I've never heard of the serial killer.
That's unbelievable.
Is that possible?
Unbelievable.
I would have to imagine that was the biggest story in Phoenix for a long time, no? I mean,
right?
Nine people killed? Now, here's the possibility of why it was never covered. Because apparently it was happening in a bad section of town. And so how many people are like, yeah, well, that always happens. No, it doesn't. You know, like, we're not covering Chicago all the time.
Right. And it could be that.
True. I mean, and could it be? Because this, what I hear this all the time. All the time. No, the violence and the kidnappings and stuff, they're not bad. Isn't it Phoenix or Tucson? Phoenix is the capital.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's weird stuff with that stat. But yeah, you're right.
At least top two or three.
One of the big complaints about it, though, was, these are just drug dealers killing other drug dealers.
Correct. Yeah, no. Right. I mean, the kidnapping capital
and
of the world.
Kidnapping, drug dealers kidnapping other drug dealers.
Right. It was like, it's crazy. It's we've beaten Bogota, Colombia. Now, where that stat stands today, I don't know. We saw it a couple of, a few years ago, but it's still in the top three or five. Now, how's that possible in the United States of America? Because of what Stu said. People are like, yeah, well, it's just drug dealers, you know, kidnapping other illegal drug dealers' children or illegal drug dealers kidnapping illegal aliens. Oh, well, then I don't care.
Yeah, I care.
I care about people, whether they're
right.
Look, you're a drug dealer. There is a certain risk to that profession that I would say is implied when you start it. I'm sure that the murder rate there is going to be higher than, you know, obstetricians. Yeah, I don't know why I couldn't say that word.
Yeah.
For a minute. But you know, certainly it's going to be higher. However, I do think that there's a.
I think as an obstetrician in today's world, you have a better chance of going to jail than if you're an illegal alien drug dealer.
That's probably true.
Yeah,
it's probably true. But I mean, there is an element of news that is focusing on the abnormal, right? And if people just standing at their gas pump for no reason being shot out of nowhere.
Well, that's what happened with this guy. This guy was just standing in the street
and
just shooting people and getting away with it.
Incredible.
Street serial killer.
Incredible.
Never heard of him. They arrested him in Phoenix. Why haven't we heard of that story? Back in a minute.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
Glenn Beck Program.
Went to Guardians of the Galaxy last night with the kids. Took the whole family. I'm a huge fan of Guardians of the Galaxy. The whole family is. We're huge fans of the soundtrack. I mean, the summer that came out, we were on vacation. We saw it on vacation, and it lasted all summer. I mean, we made jokes. I am Groot the whole summer long.
Right.
It was a summer that will be burned into the memories of my kids for their whole life, the summer of Guardians of the Galaxy, just to put it into perspective. Okay. I heard all of these movie reviews that said, oh, it's the greatest. It's so much better than the first one. And I'm like, yeah, okay, well, we'll see. Because that never happens. When's the last time you saw a movie that was better than the first one? And the first one has to be good.
I mean, I don't remember. Right? I mean, it's been a long time.
Like Cloverleaf Lane? Cloverfield, that's what it is. Right. Cloverfield. That one came out and it was like, okay. But then the sequel to that was much, much better.
It's a weird example.
Well, because I'm trying to think of anything where the first movie, where they made a sequel.
Right, back in the 70s maybe, right? The Godfather.
Godfather 2 is certainly one that people would point to in that conversation. I mean, Empire Strikes Back is certainly one I would point to. I mean, there are a few examples, but it's rare.
Rare.
Right, real rare.
So I'm like, yeah, whatever. I think this movie is close to the most perfect movie I've ever seen.
Jeez, really?
Wow.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. Tanya had the only complaint in the family. She thought the music was better in the first one, but as a kid of the 70s, not so much. I mean, I thought they did some really good stuff. We'll start with, and I'm not going to give any spoilers away. I won't tell you anything about the movie itself. No spoilers.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, right.
I want to see it.
But I will tell you things like CGI, which you don't go to a movie for CGI. And CGI has gotten to the point where you're like, okay, whatever. Oh, everything's exploding. Got it. They do some scenes in here with some amazing things with, battle scenes and everything else that are incredible. But I can get good CGI in space all day long. CGI in the opening scene, they take, and I'm not spoiling anything, Kurt Russell is in this movie. They take Kurt Russell and they use CGI to create the Kurt Russell that I remember growing up in the 1970s. Okay? And I can't tell it's CGI. Jeez. Tanya said, who is that? How did they get him to look so much? And I said, honey, that's CGI. No, it's not. Yeah, it is. I cannot see the CGI. It is, I mean, it's the most incredible. I see the CGI that just came out in the new Star Wars with the, with a general and then
and
Leia.
Carrie Fisher, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I could spot that a million. It looked like, to me, it looked like a game. And, that's good CGI, but it doesn't look real. I cannot tell the difference between real and CGI in this. It's unbelievable, okay? So the special effects are incredible. They do things like seeing the shockwave off of the wings of things when they're in the atmosphere that nobody's going to really appreciate. But it was the attention to detail that was just incredible. The script was funnier, I thought, than the first one. Hard, hard laughs. Even the new characters, it's like, is that girl with antenna? Is she going to be a Jar Jar Binks? Stop. She was great. They all were great. Now, I don't like people go like, well, there were holes in the storyline. You can't jump into hyperspace. Shut up. It's a raccoon driving the ship. So please don't talk to me about holes in the plot. I didn't see any, but I'm not one of those guys who looks for those kinds of things. When I'm going to see a show about a talking raccoon. I thought it was as close to a perfect movie as anything I've seen.
And you're saying in the genre, or you're saying overall movies?
Name movies that you think were pretty darn perfect.
I mean, I guess you're going into like more like Oscar-winning types. We put it in that category.
I said movie. Yeah, I think this could win an Oscar for several things.
Wow.
But it won't, but it could.
I don't know. I mean, it might. Maybe, I mean, $146 million opening weekend. Now, Guardians of the Galaxy, the original, did 94 and was gigantic. This did 146.
Second biggest opening. Yeah.
That's domestically, because worldwide, it's already done $427 million.
Yeah. Oh, this thing is...
I mean, that's...
All right, let me ask you this. 2 hours, 17 minutes.
Ooh. Not a problem.
It was a little long.
Not a problem. Never slowed down. Never felt long. Never looked at my watch. Never thought, oh, geez, how long is this going to go? I mean, in thinking about it, didn't think of a scene. I can't think of a scene that felt long. Didn't know it was that long.
Wow.
Yeah, didn't know it was that long. I mean, this thing, I mean... I don't know, especially when you have a sequel,
you know, then the movie execs are like, we could make $1 billion with this one. Quick, get some more people to think it through. And then they have a whole room full of people that are like, no, 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 well, that might offend this group, so you don't want to do that. Well, hang on, don't offend that group if you go with that joke. And they wreck the movie. I don't know how they pulled this one off. It's better than the first. And I can't think, I mean, I know there are other movies that are out there that are just flawless, you know. But in this genre, it is by far the best Marvel. By far the best Marvel. And I like Marvel movies. Stu doesn't. I see every Marvel movie that comes out. I love them. I mean, this is by far the best.
When you're talking sequels, I mean, most people, the standard is typically Speed 2, Cruise Control.
Oh, and, don't even go there. That was a flaw. No, I'm talking. That was perfect and flawless.
Okay.
That was colorless.
What a huge mistake that they didn't get all the original people back for that one. Wow. You want to talk about just burning money? By the way, it is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is the number 219 movie all time worldwide after 4 days.
Wow.
I mean, this is going to be a hit. It's going to be a hit. It's going to be successful.
Chris Pratt is, I mean, he's key to this movie.
Oh, I mean, they all are.
They're all so good. But Chris Pratt is just, he's on his way to being the Jimmy Stewart, Tom Hanks of this generation.
Yeah, he's a money printing machine.
Yeah.
But
he's likable.
It's an interesting parallel because, I mean, came from comedy.
Yep.
You know, has that sensibility, but also can really act, can pull everything off, is known as a nice guy, never pisses you off.
Yep.
I mean, he's going
to. He has a very, very, very long career.
If I were him, I would not be overly concerned with my 401k. I mean, I wouldn't be. I might put it in riskier investments and risk, you know, potentially losing some in a market correction.
Right.
That's the sort of choices I'd be making.
Yeah. Wow, that's good.
It's that type of life.
So you actually like Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yeah, and I don't like any of these movies, as you know. I'm not a superhero movie fan per se. I typically like them a lot more when they're sort of sarcastic and self-aware.
But aren't those all, I mean, aren't all of Avenger movies kind of?
No, I mean, that's why, like, if I'm going to pick one from, like, the mainstay that's happening now, it would be Iron Man. Like, because I like his attitude.
Right.
But, like, you know, Captain America, eh.
Captain
America. And I know you love that, the Winter Soldier or whatever that came out a couple years ago. You love that.
I like him.
But most of the time, I don't like that. I did like Deadpool for the same reasons, I think.
Yeah, I didn't see Deadpool. I saw, like, 15 minutes of Deadpool, and it was just too much. It was just, I didn't even think. You know me, I have a very dark sense of humor. I don't get Deadpool. That's weird for me.
That's surprising. But I mean, you also saw only 15 minutes of it, so maybe it would have turned you around. I did like that one. But I mean, that's the type I would like. Most of them I don't. But Guardians of the Galaxy, I remember when I saw the first preview for Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, I am not even familiar at all with the comic book. I didn't even know it existed. It looked like legitimately the worst decision I had ever. You've got a talking raccoon and a tree in a movie. The big hook is they're playing cassette tapes of 80s songs. Is that really
fantastic?
I mean, the preview when I first saw it, I was like, this is going to lose $1 billion. And by the way, Trump is definitely going to lose the election. But I mean, this is going to lose $1 billion.
I said in the movie last night, laughed really loud. I love to listen to my wife laugh. We used to watch The Office. And honestly, she watched The Office. I watched her. I'd sit back on the couch and I would just watch her just laugh. I love my wife's laugh. And so yesterday, last night, she was laughing so hard. And I love anything that makes her laugh, I'm in love with. And so we're laughing together, really, really funny parts. But as many times as I laughed, as I'm critiquing the movie in as way nobody else would, I just kept, I bet I said 4 times out loud to myself, wow. Just thinking, wow. This is perfect. You know, you're looking at the script and the acting and the CGI and the pacing and the comedy, all of it together, and the music. There were several times I sat in the movie theater, at least 4, and just went, wow. It's a good movie.
That is not only high praise from you, but also the fact that you didn't spoil anything in the movie is stunning to me. The audience is on the floor.
Never happens.
I cannot believe you did not ruin the movie.
That is probably the most flawless movie review I have done.
That's true.
Glenn Beck Program.
888-727-BACK.
Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
All right, so I stand corrected on one part. The Kurt Russell scene, they're saying, is not all CGI, but it's makeup. But when you see the opening 60 seconds of Guardians of the Galaxy, Kurt Russell comes on and you're like, that's not Kurt Russell today. That's Kurt Russell 30 years ago. I mean, exact. And I thought that they had done, remember, what was it in, Ant-Man, when Michael, you didn't see it. Did anybody see it? Michael Douglas comes out and he looks like the young Michael Douglas. That's all CGI. And that was really good. But that's not this. This, according to Cinema Blend, Kurt Russell says, I have a terrific makeup guy. We've done 28 movies together. He did a lot of makeup with me with some of his own tricks, and it's just about 90% that. They didn't do much digitally. It's amazing what you could do and what you can do with a wig. And then, you know, lighten your voice, pick up your physicality, and play it. You just play young. I will tell you, boy, he pulled that off. It was stunning. When you see this, it's stunning how they've done that.
We're going to get to that point where computers are just doing everything, from acting to...
So I'm reading an article yesterday about Coca-Cola and how Coca-Cola now has a digital jingle machine. So when they're writing their music and their jingles, it's all artificial intelligence. They're like starting to get rid of people. Sarah, did you pull any of those examples? Go ahead and play this. Okay, so
these are the first examples.
This is
right?
The first example of CGI. Oh, sorry, not CGI. AI written music.
And you might think, oh, that just sounds like normal piano playing. That's a big deal when you don't have a human being doing it.
Right. It's not. I mean, how do you even teach it how to? I mean, garbage in, garbage out. And apparently, they've got this down. It's running classical music, pop music, jingles. Now, this isn't so hard because it's like... I mean, it's like jazz that you don't understand. You're like, okay, that doesn't really work. I'm not that impressed. I mean, when I were... This piece is the first AI... constructed piece, I believe, ever.
It sounds like someone playing violin when they're really cold.
Yeah.
Like their arms are
So I don't know how Coke is using it. I was reading an article on the coming of AI yesterday, and it said all these different companies. It said Coke is using all kinds of AI technology to write music and jingles for the company now. I'm like, when did this happen? What? Really? You're going to be so shocked to find out. We've been CGI and AI for a very long time. And intelligence is not really the operative word there, but it's artificial something that we've been doing. Back in just a minute.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Common sense in America. Now, just a basic understanding of what it means to be in America would mean to be an American would help you understand why people are disgusted with Washington and the media. but the media still can't get it, but they're getting closer. The Atlantic has a story today. It was cultural anxiety that drove white working class voters to Trump. I want you to listen to this story, what they found. And then I would love for the media and the elites in Washington to hear my response, because they're making the easy things hard. We should spend more time making the hard things easy, don't you think? We start there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
According to The Atlantic, white Americans carried Donald Trump to the White House. He won college-educated white voters by a four-point margin over Hillary Clinton, according to exit polls. But his real victory was among members of the white working class. Twice as many of those voters cast their ballots for the president as for Clinton. In the wake of Trump's surprise win, some journalists, scholars, and political strategists argued that economic anxiety drove these Americans to Trump. But new information, a post-election survey conducted by the Public Religion Research Institute, The Atlantic found something different. Evidence now suggests that financially troubled voters in the white working class actually preferred Clinton over Trump. Beside partisan affiliation, it was cultural anxiety. Listen to this, it sounds at all like anything we've talked about for the last 4 years. Feeling like a stranger in America. People who voted for Donald Trump, many of them felt like a stranger in their own country. We said that there were three things that drove Americans that you need to understand. One, nobody's listening to me. Two, I don't feel like I belong anywhere. Three, I have no control over my own life. Those are the three drivers right now. Nobody's listening to me. Will somebody listen to me, please? They say they're listening, but they turn around and do the exact opposite thing. They're not really listening. I don't feel I belong here anymore. I don't even recognize my own country. I told you, you wouldn't. That's what's happening to us. That's why Donald Trump won. And once you understand that, then you can change your behavior to lead us out of this. This data adds to the public mosaic-like understanding of the 2016 election. It suggests Trump's most powerful message, at least among some Americans, was about defending the country's culture, because this message seemed to have resonated so deeply with voters. Trump's policy, speeches, and eventual re-election may depend on their perception of how well he fulfills it. The Atlantic surveyed American voters and how they were feeling about politics. They focused on white working class voters, people without college degrees or salary jobs. This group accounts for one-third of American adults. They make up a bigger share of the population in the Midwest than they do in any other region, and more than half of rural Americans are part of the white working class. As it turns out, this would become one of the most decisive groups of voters in the election. They wanted a sense of why. They found 64% of these voters have chosen Trump, 32% Clinton. While white, non-college-educated voters tend to prefer Republicans, Trump won them by a larger margin than any presidential candidate since 1980. So why? Handful of factors, they say, drove the white working-class voters. Things have changed so much that I often feel like a stranger in my own country. Now, so this is not hatred. This isn't xenophobia. It's not bigotry. It's not sexism. It's not bigotry of Muslims, fear of Muslims. It's not bigotry of Hispanics. And that's why the press isn't making any progress because they only see it that way. And it's not. It is the American people standing up and saying, I don't know how to protect my children anymore. I don't know. We are so far out of whack with the things that I have always believed. And I'm willing to change. I'm willing to make progress. We're a good country. And because we're a good country, we recognize our mistakes and we move forward. And we were making progress. But you have taken this and moved it so far, so fast, I don't even know what's true anymore. And you're telling me to deny everything that I've always known is true. For instance, let's just start at the easy one. 31% of Americans now support the House GOP health care bill. Only 31%. And what are they telling us? It's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Why do we not believe them? Because they didn't let us see everything that was in it. They didn't wait for real scores. And you know in your gut, it's the same thing, if not worse. They're lying to you. That's the easy place to go. It gets harder when you read a story like this. I read a story, this story last night. Now listen to this. This is from the Daily Mail. If your relationship is going through a rough patch and feels like you've exhausted all of your options, you might want to read one expert's advice. The author of Curious History of Dating has shared insightful guide on how to salvage any relationship in a few small steps. It's cliche to say that all relationships take work to make them work. But I've just written the history of dating, and it's definitely true that beyond abuse and major lies, current generations need to do better at sticking out the tedious patches if they want to reap the rewards of long-term love. Okay, advice my grandmother would have given. Here's a guide, blah, blah, blah. If you're having doubts about your relationship, first you need to draw up an inventory of what you truly want out of a relationship and where they're falling short. Ask your partner to do the same, but be realistic. Most of our partners to fulfill too many of our needs, quite different than what our grandparents and great-grandparents expected. Human connection, generally made on five broad areas: sexual, emotional, spiritual, political, educational, work-based. If you're connecting in three out of the five of these areas with your current partner, that's pretty good going. But ideally, you want to connect on most of the important ones, the ones that are most important to you. Fixing the physical. So first, the first one they go to is fixing the physical. Not being compatible isn't a reason to break up. Desire comes and goes, long-term relationships. So you can ask yourself and ask your spouse or partner. Open up about the discussion about sex that you're having versus sex you'd like to have. Make some list of things you'd like to try. Pledge to be open to trying something off each other's blah, 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 blah. Human connection is based on those five areas, the first being sexual. If you're connecting three out of the five, why is this printed like this? Hang on just a second. If sex is really the only thing troubling the relationship, perhaps it's an otherwise successful long-term marriage with children, then as a last resort, ask your partner if they're open to negotiating sex with other people. What? So make a list and then try that. And I think actually number two, and this was printed wrong for some reason, number two I think was give it a rest for a while, abstain for a while. And if that doesn't work, try swingers clubs. It actually is in here. So you see if they're open to together at swingers parties or separate via private arrangements. Oh, okay. No, I don't think that's, wow, that's your third point of advice. Your first place to go on dating is sex. Make a list, give it a rest, try swinging. I don't fit in the, I read this last night and I went, okay, well, it's not aimed at me and I don't know who it's aimed at. But apparently that's our culture now. Try this one. Could it be, from theblaze.com, stay-at-home moms are bad for children? Studies confirmed common sense or they're wrong. Blah, blah, blah. Recent New York Times story purport a document mounting evidence of advantage of children of working mothers. Not benefits, advantages. Preferable to mothers who don't work outside the... preferable to the mothers who don't work outside the home. Mom, stay-at-home moms, experts are now saying, are bad. somehow or another. How about this one? 10-year-old suspended for making fingers into the shape of guns. How many times have we read that story? Middle school student suspended for liking a photo of a gun on Instagram. Should it be illegal to be a stay-at-home mom with school-age kids? That's building on the New York Times story. Why the 40-hour work week is dying. Another story. 10-year-old suspended, finger gun. Dad says he was goofing off with friends. Suspension happened on a zero-tolerance policy. Then how many genders do we have? Quick! Two. Male, female. No, we don't. I asked Stu, I said, can you bring up a list of the genders? And he said, yeah, but there's only 53 now on Facebook. Nope, been updated. It's over 60 now. But that doesn't include all of them, which I've seen a list as large as 91. There is agender, androgynous, bigender, cisgender, cisfemale, cismale, cisman, ciswoman, cisgender, female, cisgender, male, cisgender, man, cisgender, woman, female to male, FTM, gender fluid, gender nonconforming. By the way, this is the list on Facebook when you want to say who you are. Gender variant, gender queer, intersex, male to female, MTF, neither, neutra, non-binary, other, pangender, trans with a asterisk, trans female, trans asterisk female, trans male, trans asterisk male, trans man, trans asterisk man, trans person, I'm just not going to keep going through all these, trans feminine, transgender female, transgender male, transgender man, transgender person, transgendered woman, trans masculine, transsexual female, transsexual male, transsexual man, transsexual person, transsexual woman, two-spirit. I love the two-spirit. What are you? Oh, I'm two-spirit.
Two-spirit.
Oh, okay. All right. Gender. I don't know how to navigate the world when it is him, her, or them, and we're talking about one individual, which is what one of the presenters of the MTV Music or Movie Awards on Sunday refers to themselves as. Them. It's one person. And the press needed to tell me how normal that was. It's not. I'm sorry. Now, maybe that's the future. But don't act like everybody who doesn't get it right is somehow a hate monger on day number one. I can't keep up with all of them. Try this one. Why did President Trump win the election? Why did President Trump actually win the election? Well, I contend once again that it is because we don't feel like we fit in. We don't recognize. Quote, I consider myself trans species. That's the headline. Fantasy fan transforms himself into an elf with $25,000 of plastic surgery, including full body hair removal, skin bleaching, and eye coloring. A fantasy fanatic who has spent more than $25,000 in plastic surgery as he wants to become a real-life elf. Okay, he's not an elf. He's never going to be an elf. He's a man who has led a very sad life. He has had a horrible childhood where he didn't feel like he fit in, and now, to be different, he feels he needs to live as an elf to be happy. That's a sad story. That's not a happy story. That's not even a story of society and how we're changing. That is a sad, tragic story. How do we not see it that way? When we are forced to say Bruce Jenner is now Caitlyn Jenner, which nobody had a problem with. Did you notice that? Nobody had a problem electing Barack Hussein Obama which Obama sounds like Osama, the number one guy we were trying to kill in a war, and Hussein was the number two guy we were trying to kill. Nobody had a problem with that. It was fodder for jokes, but we couldn't even tell the jokes. Bruce Jenner becoming Caitlyn Jenner. You know why we didn't have a problem? Because we're decent human beings. And we saw Bruce Jenner and thought, my gosh, this whole time he's been in our lives, he's lived with this in his head. He's lived with this torture, afraid to say anything. God bless him. I don't condemn him. I feel for him. My heart broke for him when I heard that story. Okay. So he's now going to become a woman. Okay, that's his choice. But then I'm forced to say he makes a beautiful woman or I'm a bigot? That's insanity. You want to know why Donald Trump won? And people like Donald Trump will continue to win over and over and over and over again? Because I'm sorry. In 1984, it was called Newspeak, where they'd strap a rat to your face until you agreed that 2 + 2 = 5. Well, I'm never going to go there. People are afraid. And they're not afraid of things that are different. They're afraid of losing things they know they can count on. They want to make sure they don't lose their connection to each other and to lasting principles. You've taken almost every lasting principle as elites and then just called us bigots because we don't agree with you on day number one. People are saying enough is enough. They have enough to be worried about, their jobs and their finances. And if you think that didn't play a role, you're fooling yourself. That played a big role. But they're worried about that, and then they're worried about losing everything that they ever felt was true. When is anybody in Washington or the media going to get it?
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So, here's the opposite of that. What have Americans done? Americans have found some place where they feel normal. They feel they recognize it. And they leave it on in their house all the time. It's HGTV. Especially with Chip and Joanna. Chip and Joanna are normal people. She just gave some advice. She said, trust your instinct. Go with your gut. Don't try to please the crowd all the time. And I'm proud to call Texas home. I'm proud to call Waco home. Think about what Waco was before they got there. Wacko Waco. And now, it's this thriving little great town.
Oh, and that bakery. Oh my God. Yeah. The bakery in that place. It's unreal.
That's who America really is. Chip and Joanna. Be more like that. And you'll feel at home again.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
You know, it's funny. We were talking about Chip and Joanna Gaines from Waco and HGTV. And one of the reasons why they come under attack is because they're people of faith. And people of faith are not wanted in the mainstream media. And you know, you look at the heroes in our culture. And we have erased almost everything. What makes Chip and Joanna Chip and Joanna? It's their faith, according to them. And how is that hurting anybody? And why shouldn't we focus on that? Why do we not talk about it? For a couple of reasons. We're Americans, and we don't like somebody preaching about their faith. But there's a difference between talking about how great God is and preaching about faith. But I remember for a long time, most of my career, been in this month, I've been in broadcast for 40 years this month.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, 40 years this month?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's insanity.
Either the 8th or the 18th, I can't remember which, but that's my first broadcast 40 years ago this month. And at the beginning, I didn't have a problem. I wouldn't have had a problem saying about God or anything else. And then it just changed. And you didn't say God. You didn't talk about church. You didn't talk about... You wanted to distance yourself a little bit from that because that wasn't cool. And then nobody talks about that. And there was a change in me 17 years ago. Not longer than that. Probably 20 years ago now. The second half of my career, the successful side, was when I was like, I don't care. You can't understand people. Especially some people, that's what drives them. What drove Jackie Robinson? We know Jackie Robinson, we know him as this courageous guy. First black player in Major League Baseball. Had death threats. Sniper that was going to take him out as soon as he stepped up to the plate. Courage. Did you know that he gave sermons on Sunday? Do you know that he wrote a collection of sermons that are just profound? Do you know what actually drove him? Do you know what drove some of the white players around him to stand up? And when somebody was going to take a shot at him, he raised his hand. He said, I'll stand right behind him. There are worse ways to go. Do you know what drove that guy? Did you even know that story? No. 1777, Benjamin Rush attended the Continental Congress in Philadelphia, sat down next to a man and asked him if he thought they'd be successful in their struggle with Great Britain. The man said, yes. Clearly, yes. If we fear God and repent for our sins. The man Benjamin Rush was sitting next to, John Adams. You read John Adams today, you read anything about John Adams, you're not going to read that stuff. You'd never know it from modern history books. Historians have been painting Adams as an enemy of Christians. But is that who he was? God is systematically being written out of every single story from Adam's life, and most people have no idea who he really was. But it's not just Adams. It's everybody. Did you ever see Walk the Line? The story of Johnny Cash? Great movie. I talked to Johnny Cash's son because I know the life of Johnny Cash. Johnny Cash is the first time I ever saw awe in my grandfather's face. I was really young. He came to the Puyallup Fair. Johnny Cash did. My grandfather ran the chicken coop or the chicken house in the Puyallup Fair, the barn. So we would go every year. Grandpa would never go to the shows. Grandpa was busy talking to people and whatever. He went to Johnny Cash and I stood next to him. And all I remember is this bus coming out into the field, pulling up to the stage, seeing a man get out, walk right up onto the stage. He was all dressed in black. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but I now know it was, hello, my name is Johnny Cash. And I remember my grandfather jumping to his feet. And I didn't look at the stage. I looked up at my grandfather as he was applauding. I'd never seen my grandfather do something like that, where he was a fan. And until I knew the Johnny Cash story, I thought, you know, as I got older, listen to the music. You know, I killed a man just to watch him die. I mean, hello. My grandfather was not into the prison, San Quentin. What? Why is he a fan of this guy? Because of who he was. I talked to Johnny Cash's son. I said, how did you leave all of that God stuff out? He said, we tried. But he was telling me, did you know my father, Johnny Cash, did you know that when he changed, when he really became a follower of God, he looked at June and said, we got to sell our Cadillac. What are we doing? We don't need this big Cadillac. We don't need this big house. Who do we really follow? Are we a servant? Are we a shepherd? Are we a steward? Or do we own this stuff? They got rid of it all, took everybody on their staff and went to Jerusalem for a while. And he reset his whole life and said, this is who we are. And then they went back out on the road. That's the guy my grandfather stood for. But you wouldn't know that about Johnny Cash. They left out, this is kind of a major thing. During the height of Johnny Cash's depression and the height of his drug use, Johnny Cash drove out to a series of caves. He went out there all by himself, didn't tell anybody. Depressed, strung out, he wanted to end his life in those Tennessee caves. But he said, he wrote later, as he lay there in the dark, something happened. There, quoting him, in Nickajack Cave, I became so conscious of a very clear, simple idea. I'm not in charge of my destiny. I'm not in charge of my life, my death. I was going to die at God's time, not mine. I hadn't prayed over my decision to seek death in the cave, but that hadn't stopped God from intervening. He said he felt an urge and a breeze moving him in a specific direction. He got lost in the cave, but he felt, follow this breeze. It led him to the exit of the cave. When he got out from the cave, there was June and his mom waiting at the edge of the cave with food and water. When he got out, he said, how did you know I was here? They said, they knew that something wasn't right and they needed to go find Johnny, and they just were told, wait here. God saved Johnny Cash from killing himself. That's his words. He stopped using drugs, was performing again by November 1967. And all they said about that in the movie is, you know, a connection to God. How can you tell the story of Johnny Cash's second part of his life and omit the most amazing part of it? Let me tell another story of a time of great political upheaval. This mom and this dad, kind of outcasts in the community, especially the mom. Nobody trusts these people at all. In fact, the leadership of the community and people from all over, the big great powers, they send people to watch. They send people trying to find them. One group of guys meet with the mom and dad, who are now parents, and they warn them that you're in trouble. Help them try to escape. The sinister nature of this meeting is quite obvious. I mean, who else? Why would important men meet with this guy? He's just a tradesman. Why are they meeting in a place where it's clandestine? And then the kid's upbringing is even more suspicious. He goes missing for 18 years, and then suddenly he resurfaces as a rebel, gets in all kinds of political mischief, undermines the local government officials, lies constantly, tries to trick people. Eventually, he gains a bunch of followers all over. This subversive movement is on the verge of overthrowing everything because these revolutionaries are coming from small town to small town and all gathering support and then hiding out. Just as the movement descends on the capital, The guy's turned in because he's not going to kill everybody in the Capitol. So he's executed. His followers then have this great plan to steal his body and utilize a double to make it appear he wasn't killed at all. It was a bloodless coup to upend the system. Change the course of history. That's the story of Jesus without God. How can you possibly... How can the greatest story ever be told when you're not telling the greatest part of the stories? If you leave out God in faith, for many people, it can't be done. The story becomes something entirely different. A mixture of plot lines of Che Guevara and Harry Potter, a magician who is also a rebel. The story of John Adams, Johnny Cash, without their stories of faith in God. It changes who they are. We have to decide who we are and what we're going to accept. And we need to start looking for those stories in our life and then make sure we're telling the real story of people. But that's the problem we have. I started the hour with trying to explain to the mainstream media why Donald Trump, the Atlantic is still looking. Why did Donald Trump win? They said it's not really anything about now except for culture now. I mean, yes, it had some things to do with the economy, but it also had something to do with culture because people felt like they didn't belong anymore. Yeah, we don't. Because you belittle or erase everything we know is true. And they're not going to change that. And that's okay. They can do what they do. Let's just make sure we're doing what we're supposed to do. Do what we're here for.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program. 888-727-BECK.
The amazing story of the Jackie Robinson, the rest of the Jackie Robinson story. It's a new book called 42 Faith, and Ed Henry from Fox News is going to be joining us here in a second. He is the chief national correspondent for Fox News based in Washington, D.C. He's one of the few guys in journalism who has stayed the course, through Obama and through Donald Trump as well, asking the tough questions. Great journalist. We're going to talk to him in just a few minutes about his book. And speaking of books, do you guys know anything about the new Ivanka Trump book, Women Who Work?
I've only seen the sort of mocking reviews of it.
There's plenty of that. There's plenty of mocking reviews.
Okay, I mean, and that has nothing to do with the book, right? It's just...
That's the way I took it.
It's just they don't like Donald Trump.
So you remember Jack, who wrote The Overton Window with me. Mm. This is a guy who, they said he was a combination of Stephen King and Tom Clancy, the greatest writer ever. He ghost wrote The Overton Window with me. And all of a sudden, it was written by a 4-year-old. Okay? It's amazing. It's amazing. They're doing it now to Ivanka Trump. And I want some, next hour, I'm going to ask for 4 women that are willing to read this. I don't want you to be a big Trump supporter or a big anti-Trump person. I just want you to be regular down the middle and you want to read this book. Call me.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Steven Seagal has been banned from the Ukraine for 5 years. Palling up to Vladimir Putin.
Oh, no.
Oh, crap, I can't go to the Ukraine? Oh, right. What am I going to do for vacation? That really stinks. It's weird how many people are cozying up to Vladimir Putin. Time has a new poll out. 31% of Americans support the House GOP health care bill. Stu has some interesting facts from the last health care bill, which does not bode well for the GOP. We'll get into that. Also, we've just spent some time on on how America tells stories, how we are leaving out really important facts. We're not just leaving God out anymore. We are truly cutting him out. I mean, we are cutting around sharp corners to make sure that you never see anyone who is influenced by God. We think we know the Jackie Robinson story. We don't. Ed Henry, one of a journalist and chief national correspondent for Fox News Channel, based in Washington, one of the real good guys, a guy who stood and held principles firm during Obama and is doing the same again under Donald Trump, guy we really respect, joins us now talking about his new book called 42 Faith, the rest of the Jackie Robinson story, and it will blow your mind what has been left out of his story. We go there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Welcome to the program, Ed Henry. How are you, sir?
Good. Thanks for having me on, Glenn.
You bet. I would love to talk to you about politics and what you see going on, but I really want to spend some time talking about Jackie Robinson, because I think until we get the story of America right and the story of our heroes, we're never going to be able to. We're playing games, and we're never going to be able to fix our country. So I'm glad you're here, and your book is absolutely fantastic. I don't follow sports, but even I know who Jackie Robinson is. At least that's what I thought until I read your book.
Well, I appreciate that, because I think there's a whole lot more to the story, and Hollywood doesn't want, as you know better than anyone, to touch faith in God. They don't want to talk about that. And so there was a movie, 42, about Jackie Robinson and Branch Rickey, the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, who signed him to the first contract to break the color barrier in Major League Baseball, which obviously, as you suggest, did not just change sports. It changed America for the better forever. But Hollywood, you know, the 42 movie was wonderful, but it barely mentioned God. I found out new information, which is why I wrote this book, that Branch Rickey, right before signing Jackie to the first contract in 1945, secretly had doubts. He had second thoughts. He almost pulled out. But it was a secret meeting with a minister in Brooklyn at a wonderful church that still stands today, Plymouth Church, which was a stop on the Underground Railroad in the 1800s. So when you talk about getting our history right, this was a pivotal church in helping end slavery in the 1800s. And then in 1945, Branch Rickey, I learned, and it's in 42 Faith, basically goes to this minister and says, I don't know if I can go through with this, because this was such a controversial move in 45 to move to integrate Major League Baseball. And after pacing and praying on all of this, a 45-minute meeting that I uncovered the details of with this minister in Brooklyn, Branch Rickey finally sits down, starts crying, and says to the minister, I've decided to sign Jackie to the first contract. I needed to be in your presence, he says to the minister. I needed to be in God's presence to know it was the right thing to do.
Okay, so now this story were told today or happened today, here's how this story would be spun. That Branch Rickey wanted to do it because he was going to have all kinds of publicity and that would be good for the club. And he made this pilgrimage to a black church that was the perfect church because of the history, so everybody would know. And he was only doing this for show.
Yeah.
Correct.
And I think it.
Correct that.
That would be correct. That would be the way it might be played now. But the fact of the matter is, what this led me to do was go on a journey and think and figure out and research. And I spent almost 10 years doing this on the side, you know, in the back burner while covering politics, as you said at the top. And it made me say, wait a second, how much did God and faith in God play in this monumental decision that, again, wasn't just about baseball, but maybe more importantly, how much of a role did faith play in helping Jackie Robinson overcome people shouting the N-word at him, people literally threatening his life because he wanted to play baseball? And I found a lot of new information. I'll tell you one quick story about Branch Rickey. In the early 1900s, he grows up on a farm in Ohio along the Kentucky border. And he goes to his mom, Branch Rickey does, and says, I want to become a big league ball player. She says no. She was a Methodist and said, all baseball players do is drink and swear and party, and you're not doing that. Well, Branch Rickey goes back to her the next day. This is somebody who didn't take no for an answer, obviously, or he might have backed down and not integrated the game of baseball decades later. But in the early 1900s, he said, "Mom, if you let me chase my dream to play big league baseball, I will never play on Sunday." And do you know that Rickey became a big league ball player before he was a famous executive? A lot of people don't know that. He never played on Sunday. It's one reason why he got cut, because owners of various teams said, "Why am I paying you a full week's salary when you won't play on Sunday to honor God?" And then fast forward to after he signs Jackie Robinson and he's this famous executive for the Brooklyn Dodgers, I interviewed Branch Rickey's grandson. Branch Rickey III is still alive. He says that in the 40s and 50s, Rickey would never go to Ebbets Field in Brooklyn on Sunday, even though he was running the team. His parents had died. Glenn, he had already, you know, that commitment he made to his parents was basically null and void. But he felt like he needed to honor that. That shows commitment, character we don't see today. It shows a commitment to God that people are frankly scared to talk about and say out loud today. But Branch Rickey and Jackie Robinson, they were one white, one black, different generations, didn't have a lot in common. But they both had a deep faith in God. And that's why I think there's a lot more to this story that people have not wanted to talk about.
So let's talk about Jackie Robinson. I had absolutely no idea he was a Sunday school teacher and that he gave a lot of sermons.
Yes. And I want to tell you about some of them. I mean, first of all, in terms of Sunday school, this is a man, Jackie Robinson, who grows up, you know, he's raised by a single mom in Pasadena, California. We hear about this a lot today, not just in the African-American community, communities all around the country, and say, well, these kids end up joining gangs and they've got no hope. Well, guess what? Jackie Robinson joined a gang. He's a teenager in Pasadena. He has a criminal record. He was arrested several times, Glenn, and people don't know that about the story. And you know how he got out of it? His mom, Mally Robinson, was a woman of faith. She happened to also be a Methodist, like Branch Rickey and his family. Interesting connection, coincidental perhaps, but still interesting. And a Christian minister named the Reverend Carl Downs in Pasadena pulled Jackie aside as a teenager and said, "You're going the wrong way. Unless you get your life back on track, you're going to waste all this athletic talent." So the Sunday school you mentioned is, I find in my research that Jackie becomes this four-letter man at UCLA, baseball, basketball, football, and track and field. He stars as a football player at UCLA on Saturdays, gets up Sunday. He's a running back, so he's beaten and bruised like any other running back. And what does he do on Sunday morning? Gets out of bed, gets off that UCLA campus, and goes back to Pasadena in order to teach Sunday school with the Reverend Carl Downs. This Jeez. Minister had saved his life, and he felt like he had a commitment to him. Again, to me, there's a wonderful parallel there with Branch Rickey, who had that commitment to his parents about faith and not playing, not working on Sundays. Jackie Robinson, how many athletes today, either college or pro, get out of bed on Sunday morning and say, you know, I'm going to teach Sunday school before I go to the game or before I do this or that? This is somebody who gave back and understood it. We can get into the sermons as well that he did after his playing days, but I think faith in God is at the center of this story, and that's why we call it 42 Faith.
I will tell you that I teach Sunday school, and it is impossible. Almost every week I think I'm going to call in sick. I've got so many things going on, blah, blah, blah. I'm not Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson is not only playing and doing all of these things, but also throughout his life, he is pushed up against the wall. When he first comes out and he's set to make his debut, there's a sniper that has threatened and said, "I'm taking him out. If he steps up to bat, I'm taking him out."
Yep. And you know what happened? We see in the movie 42 that there were white players from the Deep South who circulated a petition and said, if Jackie gets promoted to the big leagues in 1947, we're going to walk. And so we can't sanitize that history. There were white players, teammates, who didn't want to play with him. But you know what I found in my research is there were white teammates like Ralph Branca, a very tall pitcher. And you're right. There were these reports that came into the Dodgers April 15th, 1947. This is now the 70th anniversary that we're celebrating of Jackie's first game. He said, there's a sniper who's going to be at Ebbets Field. They're going to kill Jackie when he goes on the field. And Ralph Branca made a show on the field of standing next to Jackie and kind of throwing his arm around him. And Jackie, thankfully, is not shot. But after the game, one of Branca's brothers comes rushing up to him. He had a big family. He said, Ralphie, what were you thinking? You were standing right next to this guy, this black player who was going to get shot. There's a sniper out there, and you were standing next to him. What are you thinking? And he said, there are worse ways to go than to stand up for a teammate. That was a white pitcher. He was like 6'3", 6'4". He was a big target for a sniper. That's why I mentioned his height. And yet, his white player said, I'm going to stand up for a black teammate. That, to me, is all about not just faith, but about America, number one. And number two, you talk about commitment from Jackie. You talk about yourself teaching Sunday school. Jackie's wife, Rachel, is still alive, about 95 years old. And she remembers that first year when Jackie had snipers out there. He had people sending him letters saying, we're going to kill you. People shouting the N-word from the stands. She says that after playing at Ebbets Field every day afternoon, he'd take the subway home to the small apartment they had in Manhattan. And before he went to bed, do you know what Jackie Robinson, this famous ball player, did? She says he got down on his hands and knees and prayed to God. And I think, again, that commitment to Jack, I'm not saying that faith was the only thing that enabled him to play at athletic skill. He had courage. He had character. But faith in God was at the center of Jackie Robinson's life. And it's not something a lot of people have talked about before for various reasons. And I think with that image of this famous ball player getting down on his hands and knees and praying to God every night before bed shows that he got it. He understood that despite his fame, despite becoming a civil rights icon, he was imperfect. And still wanted to bow down before God.
I will tell you that I know Penn Jillette is a friend of mine, an atheist, and he has courage and principles. But and I know a lot of religious people who don't have courage and principles. But somebody like Jackie Robinson, it's hard to believe that it didn't. That wasn't what was really driving. We're talking to Ed Henry of the Fox News Channel, written a new book called 42 Faith. The rest of the Jackie Robinson story. As you were researching this, did anybody come to mind at all? Are you seeing these people, Ed, in your everyday life? Are you seeing them anywhere in positions of power?
No, I think that's something, and I'm an optimistic person, but it's someone, as I researched this, I thought about men of character like Branch Rickey, like Jackie Robinson, like Ralph Branca, who I mentioned, who stood up on faith. And you know, you mentioned the sermons that Jackie gave. I mean, I found in his personal papers at the Library of Congress all of these sermons that Jackie gave at churches all across America in the 1960s. He had hung up his glove at the beginning of 57, a baseball glove. So in the 60s, he's retired. He's working for Chock Full of Nuts. He makes the Baseball Hall of Fame. But again, he gives back. He goes to churches, not just black churches, but churches all around America. And let me read one quick passage where he talked about how he was skeptical about federal government assistance programs being what would help deal with the civil rights crisis, would deal with the long, hot summer of 1967. This was a sermon in 67, and he said, my dear friends in this congregation, I think the black man is just a little weary of this constant talk of helping him. I think to a large degree the poverty programs have fallen flat on their face, coming to resemble just some more handouts, a cut higher than welfare. God helps mankind, Jackie Robinson said, but he helps those who help themselves. So here was a civil rights icon saying that in 1967, not in a public square, but in a church, number one, Glenn, and number two, 1967, 50 years ago. Think about that statement today. We don't have a lot of people in public life saying that. And here is a black leader saying it, a black ball player who made the Hall of Fame, and an icon.
So, Ed, you and I both know what the, you know, last, since 9/11 has been like, especially at the Fox News Channel. You've been there for a long time, longer than I was, and you know what it was like when I was there, and mainly because of me causing all the trouble. Sorry for that, by the way.
I don't know where you're going with this.
Well, here's where I'm going. Was this your way of searching for some sort of bedrock that made life make sense, that gave you courage to stand? Was this just your stamp collecting thing, just to take your mind? What happened to you when you wrote this?
It started as my stamp collecting, in that I've got a passion for baseball, and a lot of people ask me, well, why in the world do you write a baseball book? I mean, number one, I don't think the world is begging for a book about Obamacare from Ed Henry. You know, I just feel like how many politics are out there? No offense to any of my colleagues or anyone. And number two is, you know, it's not really a baseball book. It's a book about faith in God. And I'm a Catholic. I'm imperfect, but you always strive to be better. And Jackie Robinson said in these personal papers I found, there are better Christians than me. I'm imperfect. And here's Jackie Robinson, who's pretty darn close to perfect. But he said, I just did the best I knew how. I'm paraphrasing. And I didn't want to let down my mother. or Mr. Ricky. I always called him Mr. Ricky. And what did Mr. Ricky, the general manager, have in common with Jackie Robinson's mother? Again, different generations, different skin color, came of age in different parts of the country. But they both, you know, both the Robinson families and the Ricky families had deep faith in God. And when Jackie Robinson says, look, I'm not imperfect, but I did the best I knew how. For me, this is a project to kind of find some deeper meaning. And I think in Jackie Robinson, it's not just a baseball story. It's a story about life. And it's a story about how faith in God is at the center of our lives, whether people want to say it out loud or not.
I will tell you, the book endorsed by Bill O'Reilly, Brad Thor, Juan Williams and Larry King. You couldn't get more eclectic than that. Oh, and Jim Brown. So no more eclectic than that. Ed, thank you so much. The name of the book is 41 Faith, a great 42 read. 42 Faith.
Mm-hmm. 42.
Yeah.
That's the prequel. It's coming out next year.
Do I understand 42 if I only read 41?
43 is going to be the best.
All right. Ed Henry, thank you very much and much success.
Thanks, buddy.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. This is
the Glenn Beck Program.
Yeah, so let's look at let's shift gears here a little bit and go to Obamacare and the stats, because this is really important. Right now, 37% of the American people say they are for the GOP's new Obamacare. Well, last time this passed, it passed with miserable numbers, but not anywhere close to 37%.
This is what's kind of interesting, is that it was about, you know, there's different polls. Like right now, the polls range from 37, but down to about 33% of support for GOP healthcare. In fact, a lot, not really much support even in GOP districts, which is problematic. The Obamacare passed, it was about between 40 and 48. It polled before the election. Now, the election has turned it's created a big upturn in support for Obamacare. So now it's popular. It's above water by about 10 points. But back in the day when it was, people were judging it more in the policy maybe than politics, it was around, it would bottom out in around 40 and then go up to around 48. And it would typically in that little canal there. But this is, right now we're looking at 33 to 37, so significantly less popular. But if you go back and look at the effect on Democratic candidates, Democratic incumbents who voted for Obamacare lost 10 to 15 points of vote margin in the 2010 midterms. 10 to 15 points. So this is from Nate Silver, if you were a Democratic incumbent poised to cruise to re-election by 11 points and you voted for Obamacare, you probably lost.
And it's worse this time for Republicans. They are in for the shellacking of their life. A reverse Tea Party is headed their way. Back in a minute.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
I just want to do a couple of minutes here on Bitcoin because I find it interesting, because Stu and I both have very little money in Bitcoin, just enough that you were like, okay, I can walk away from this and not worry about it. So we both have about $6.75 in it.
It's too rich for my blood, but I have some.
Right. So Stu bought it about $300 a coin, and it is now, is it about to cross the 1800 mark?
Yeah, it's right around there.
$1,800 per Bitcoin.
They're saying a lot of it goes to China. Instability. And it's true. China, though, both of those are true. Instability and the Chinese market has blown up. They're throwing money into this like crazy. And remember, we haven't even hit a point where there's an actual collapse of an economy. And a lot of people think that if this happens, where a currency collapses in this environment, a country may switch to Bitcoin as its actual currency.
I know.
I mean, if that were to happen, I mean, who God only knows what could happen to this? I have no idea. I mean,
and at the same time, it could completely collapse and go nowhere.
It could be zero tomorrow without any doubt at all. Like,
this is one of those things that, you know, that you're either going to look like a genius or a dummy. If you put a lot of money into it, mm-hmm. you have a better chance to look like a dummy. But, you know, this is something that your family could talk about for generations. Yeah, I know. My great-grandfather, he bought Bitcoin when it was $300 an ounce. When it was what? Right. Or a coin.
Yeah.
When it was what? But there's some changes going on with that. And I think, you know, when things go unstable, at least until they can get their arms around it. See, this is what happened to gold. Look at Bitcoin. This makes no sense. Bitcoin now is more expensive than gold. That doesn't make sense.
No, of course okay? not.
And that's because they do reverse treasuries and all of those games. They shut this down and they play all kinds of games with the manipulation of the price of gold because they know that people see gold as a signal of trouble. And so when they see gold start to fluctuate in big jumps, they freak out. Gold should probably be closer to 2,000 to 2,500. If it wasn't the artificial barriers, it'd be at least, I bet you it would be $2,000. But these artificial barriers keep them down.
And that's what happens. I think Bitcoin's even more susceptible to that, right? It's less established. Like, well, at
it's not susceptible. I don't know if anybody's trying to keep it down, but people don't know, and it's not stable, and it could go to zero. Gold will never go to zero. You know what I mean?
Right.
But it depends on what happens. Same with Bitcoin. Do they seize it? Do they not seize it? Do they make it illegal for trading in it? I don't know.
Right. That's my biggest concern. My biggest concern, as is my everything. Biggest concern with everything, is the government coming in and saying, you know what? People are doing X, Y, and Z that we don't like with this currency. Therefore, it will no longer exist. And the people who love Bitcoin say, well, they can never do that. Because it's digital and it goes around the governments and all that's true. Like it is true. It would be very difficult for the government outside of shutting the internet down completely to turn off Bitcoin. However, if you make it so that you can, you know, if the government creates a law and somehow it makes it possible that you know what, you're not allowed to accept Bitcoin. No one is allowed to have Bitcoin. It's going to chase everybody like me out of it. Because I have no interest in being on the wrong side of the law. I'm not looking to make some weird, you know, currency point here. I just find it kind of be generally interesting. And at that point, while yes, it will still exist in some world, it will no longer, I think, have the number of people involved in it that will create the increase in value.
Unless
it's
China.
Happen.
Unless China says that's our currency or that's how we're going. If China does it, then you still have all that money in Bitcoin available in China. Your job is to get to China. You know, if you had $10 million in Bitcoin, right, because you bought it, that's not crazy. Because you bought it today and currency went out and China said, oh, by the way, this is our currency. And a few markets were using that as currency. You could see that. You could see $10 million in Bitcoin. Now, get to it. You couldn't do it here in the United States, but if you could get to some place where it was free, that is one thing about, you know, people in the 1930s had to try to smuggle everything out. They were eating diamonds and everything else to try to smuggle it out. Mm-hmm. This is all up in your head. That's different than gold or anything else. You don't have to move around with it. You just have to find a way to access it, which, you know, today is easy, but if you had real global, you know, authoritarianism, well, it changes, but that changes everything anyway.
Yeah, exactly. At that point, you're at the point, you know, you're beyond what you can prepare for.
Yeah, there's no scenario for, let's see if Blade Runner comes true. There's no scenarios for Blade Runner.
Well, I mean, considering there's a sequel coming out very soon.
Okay, well, I forgot about that.
Yes,
okay,
sequel to the documentary Blade Runner 2049.
Right,
looks really good.
It looks kind of interesting.
Looks really good.
But I mean, that's the thing with this is the crazy scenario in which Bitcoin goes to 10 million is the world is such a crazy place you almost can't prepare for it.
Right.
The situation in which, you know, let's say Chuck Schumer decides, you know what, people shouldn't be able to have the freedom with their currency, so we're going to ban it. That's not an unrealistic scenario at all to me. And even if the rest of the world continues to use it, if you're an American citizen and you don't want to be, like, I'm not interested in being on the wrong side of the law.
No,
I'm not
nobody
Jeffy.
Is.
You know, I mean,
nobody is.
Nobody except Jeffy is interested in that. So the business.
No, I meant nobody.
Stop.
nobody is like Jeffy.
Nobody's like Jeffy. That's true. Okay. But like the businesses will stop accepting it, right? I mean, you know, they'll just, that won't happen anymore. And when that happens, it just becomes irrelevant to the average person in America.
Well, same thing could be said for gold or silver and not, you know.
It's true, but gold or silver is so much more established, right? Like this is something
where
the average person knows nothing
about Bitcoin. I guarantee you the government, at some point, if it crashes, the government will have to get control of the currency. They're going to have to get control. And so they will say the only way you can sell is with X, Y, or Z. Then you just have to have the courage to barter. You know, it's one thing to have gold buried in your backyard, which I would never do.
You just don't want us to dig.
What? I don't know what you're saying. So anyway, you know, it's one to have gold buried in your backyard and then, you know, take it out slyly to your neighbor and say, hey, look, bury this in your backyard. I need to buy, you know, a chicken, you know, or whatever.
A chicken?
Well, that's the only, let's be honest, guys.
Right.
I mean, if you're buying gold like I do, I don't buy it for the investment. I didn't buy Bitcoin for the investment. I buy it for an insurance policy that the whole frickin' world is burning down. So yes, I will be in the market for a chicken so I can have an egg.
I will be in the market for quinoa because I'm, as you know, a vegetarian and... In that scenario where you're trading chickens for bitcoins,
I tell you something?
I want couscous.
Isn't it? Is it couscous or quinoa? It's one of those that is now starving some, you know, South American tribe of their, because quinoa, I think it's quinoa is like the, is like wheat to this one area.
Okay.
And because quinoa has taken off so big, America is buying up all the quinoa and the people who used to live on quinoa can no longer afford it.
They should try wheat. Try any, pick up anything gluten. That's apparently, no one here wants that. Just turn into an all gluten diet. You're going to be,
and live like us. Find the miracle of science and Wonder Bread. Those little dots on the cover of Wonder Bread, those are all chemicals. They all represent a different molecule of chemicals, and you put them all together, and you got the magic of Wonder Bread. It's never seen the ground.
I don't know. Our society did pretty well when it decided it wanted to eat gluten. It had a good run, I will say. Dang. Now we're turning it around. I mean, I don't know. Is this a good idea? As Pat, if he were here, would say, staff of life. People have called it, I don't know, the staff of life. So perhaps maybe it's not the evil we're turning it into today.
Well, I don't know, man. The lactose intolerance, gluten... All this stuff that is happening now, I've got two people who are lactose intolerant, two of my children, lactose intolerant.
Tell them to stop it.
What?
Tell them to stop it. Stop it. Get over it.
Oh, I never thought of that.
Tell them to stop it. Get over it.
Okay, we went to the doctor.
All
right, we went to the doctor and stuff. We've been following that. I never thought of, wow, that's so much easier. That's cheaper, too.
It's easy.
Stop. Stop.
Okay.
Stop it.
Just stop it. What are you doing?
Well, I did make fun of him for a while. Ooh, look who can't have ice cream. Ooh, it's your birthday. Guess what daddy got? Birthday cake, ice cream.
Yeah. That went over good.
An ice cream birthday cake. Oh.
That went over great, I bet.
So stop it, blow out the candles, eat it.
Thank you.
This brings up an interesting point, by the way, Mr. Fisher here, Jeffy. And I would like to ask you if you would like to be a part of what we're in the middle of. We go on vacation in approximately 18 days.
Yes.
Okay. We have launched the 18-day Jeff Fisher Fat Guy Challenge. And the idea is to not eat like a hippopotamus who enjoys junk food for 18
days.
During
vacation?
No, 18 days. Just up to vacation. Because here's the problem here is if I go 18 more days eating like I've been eating lately, and then vacation comes on, I'm going to come back. You're going to see me in a doctor's office in Houston on my 600-pound life. That's where that ends.
I may not be able to get out of here for vacation. The fire department may have to come
and
take me out through the wall to get out of here.
The first, you know, 1,800-pound show.
Right. Right. Now, that is a way to go. You want to lose this? Oh, I was thinking it'd be... Yeah.
No,
we get all kinds of free press if we're all over 600 pounds.
And TLC has great distribution, so I mean, it might be the way to go. I'm fine with that. But I mean, I'm going to attempt.
Your skin has just attached itself to the couch.
No. Now I'm looking to attempt to at least lose some weight before vacation.
Okay, so I
can add it back.
I've been on this diet for I don't know how long. 4 weeks now? 3 weeks?
Yeah, but you're on the wrong
diet. I'm not losing anything.
You got to dive in.
Diets work. If you actually follow them, they work. I don't know what diet you have.
Don't talk to me about
diets. You have weird.
I did the 17-day juice cleanse. I finished it in 4.5 hours, so don't tell me that I don't know things about diets.
It's 17 days of juice in 4 hours.
4.5 hours. Didn't lose a damn pound and felt sick because of it. Don't do it.
I don't know what your diet is, but I mean, I'm willing to give
you. My diet is the diet that I've been on, that I was supposed to be on, then I got off it because I got frustrated. Because I remember I lost like 30 pounds, and then something happened to my body again, and all of a sudden, over like 3 weeks, I gained 20 pounds.
Well,
I went to the doctors.
Would say something that happened to your body again would be that you were putting more food into
it. No, it wasn't. It really wasn't. Even Tanya will verify. Now, probably 10 pounds of this fatness has come from just stuffing my face because I got so depressed. I've been back on that diet, and I've even been eating like half portions at least of lunch. Not even half, like a third portion at least at lunch. And I've gained 4 pounds. I can't lose it. I cannot lose it.
By the way, thank you for tuning into The View today as we discuss our weight issues.
Sorry.
It's true. Look, we are a show. We believe in federalism, do we not?
You're Whoopi Goldberg. Yes, what would you say?
We believe in federalism.
Yeah.
We're all basically the size of a state. So maybe we can all have... I'm willing to let you set your standards here. Now, the issue, of course, is
I'd like to stop gaining weight on a diet.
Okay, well, there you go. Maybe that's. I think it should be
that's
you follow letter of the law, and then subtract 20% from that, whatever letter of the law.
All
is
right,
for
I'll
you.
Do that.
And
but I may not. I may gain weight.
No, you can't.
I don't know
what.
Well,
then
gaining.
You failed.
There's no.
If
gaining.
You gain weight, you failed. That's what that means.
No, if I do letter of the law, plus 20%. And I gain weight, well, then it's just suicide. That's all that's left for me. Just suicide or just keep gaining weight until I am on TLC. Just one of the two.
Well, either way, it's a good story.
Right.
So we'll get
right?
some coverage
get some
out of
coverage
it. We'll get ratings.
Out of it. So it doesn't matter. So I'll try that.
Okay. Till right. 18
I'm not
days.
Eating during vacation. You guys all are going right. to eat like pigs on vacation?
I mean, I'm going to say no now, but yes.
I'm going to try to walk at least 2 miles a day. Downhill both ways.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Welcome to the program. Glad you're here. Tonight at 5 o'clock, we're going to talk a little bit about the Trump presidency and where it has moved in the last couple of months. There's been some tracking of their policies, and it's fascinating. It's fascinating. Mr. Trump has moved his policy dramatically. We'll talk about that at 5 o'clock only on The Blaze TV. Pat and Stu are coming up next. By the way, Pat's out this week. His mother is gravely ill. We ask for your prayers.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.